Good afternoon. This is Gordon Karkner speaking on Charles Taylor and the Modern Quest for Identity, Dialogue on a Great Mind. Doing this recording for those who couldn't make it to the lecture but want to be part of this discourse. In overview, preeminent McGill University philosopher Charles Taylor is an iconic international scholar in the field of Western modernity, and especially the late modern self. His critical thinking bridges continental and Anglo-American thought. What I'll do today is trace the contribution of Taylor on the question of identity through his three great tomes, Sources of the Self, A Secular Age, and The Language Animal. Taylor attempts to recover constitutive language in the process, the language of significance and human meaning, which is also the language of identity. And then I will finish with a case study of how his work handles the current crisis of affirmation, a dilemma in Western culture. We live in a Canadian mosaic. There's a great deal of diversity of cultures, of values, leisure, concerns, lifestyle, marital relations, religion and spirituality, intellectual and social priorities. And you could say that UBC is very much a microcosm of that diversity. But the key question we must ask ourselves is, as we celebrate diversity, how do we move towards maturity, a mature diversity? Move beyond minimalist toleration without either becoming overwhelmed by our differences or imploding into individual tribes and separating from each other. Millennials today compose the most diverse generation in Canadian history. It's deeply embedded in their consciousness. They experience a convergence of pluralism, individualism, and choice, mediated through the technological advances of the internet and social media. This is the perspective of Reginald Bibby and his group at University of Lethbridge. They have written a wonderful book called The Millennial Mosaic, How Pluralism and Choice Are Shaping Canadian Youth and the Future of Canada. Reginald Bibby, Joel Thiessen, and Moneta Bailey. I recommend this book as a reading of today's culture and the future of Canada. So when we think about identity, the existential challenge really is, who am I? Or against the vast cosmos? How do I give account of myself amidst the vast universe, amidst the complex globalization, changing world? How do I insert myself into the larger scheme of things in a meaningful and fruitful manner? Now, in our handout, we've shown that there are at least 28 different aspects of a person's identity, and that's to prove that we often think too narrowly about identity, too reductionistically. And there's a fulsome, we want to work on a fulsome definition of the self called the thick self. Taylor wants to help us reimagine this whole idea of identity. He believes that it's grounded in moral frameworks, personal ideals, and calling. Identities are constituted from moral sources that inspire, shape, and nurture the inner person. So for him, identity health also involves the recovery of constitutive language. Everyone has a stake in this question of identity. We're all working on that at all times. And to gain a healthy identity is highly to be desired. But there are barriers today to healthy, thick identity growth. You find ideological scientism. I'm just doing an upcoming publication on this, Late Modernity, The Challenge of Scientism and the Search for Meaning. A key thinker I would suggest to you is David Bentley Hart. Exclusive humanism, that is, closing the door on the immanent frame, creating a closed world system. Taylor articulates this beautifully in his book, A Secular Age, Chapter 15. And he himself is a key thinker on this concept of exclusive humanism. Then there's behavior modification, spying, and manufactured addiction through the social media. I recently discovered this philosopher from Silicon Valley, computer philosopher named Jérôme Lanier, who raises a lot of important questions about artificial intelligence and about social media. Then, fourthly, white supremacy, populism, the alt-right. This is a way of promoting societal divisiveness, tribalism, and anti-humanism, the us versus them mentality. A key thinker in this area would be Jason Stanley at Yale University. The final one is the problem of reductionistic definitions of the human person. For instance, the greedy animal, Homo economicus. Nick Henauer's TED Talk, The Dirty Secret of Capitalism, speaks to that. So these five barriers are just a sample of the kind of things that get in the way of us growing in a healthy way and of millennials developing a healthy identity in today's world. But we're not going to spend too much time on that. We're going to focus on Taylor's positive or proactive idea of identity. So the first key contribution on identity from Taylor is that it involves moral frameworks. In Sources of the Self, Taylor made a significant contribution to the recovery of the language of the good in moral discourse and agency. He kind of does what you might call a moral archaeology. He goes even back to the ancient world to show that this language of the good has been a lively part of moral discourse for centuries. My dissertation in a dialogue between Michel Foucault and Charles Taylor on moral self-constitution in quest of freedom dealt with this particular issue in great detail. For me, this was a game changer in moral philosophy, moral discourse, and moral agency. It opened me up to a whole new level of thought. I've written a paper on this called Charles Taylor's Moral Ontology, A Case for Moral Realism. You can find this paper, unpublished paper, on the webpage of the forum called ubcgfcf.com. So I'm able to go into much more detail there. I can't cover all the contours of moral frameworks here, but we'll just touch on a couple important things. This is a quote from Taylor, where he says, "I want to defend the strong thesis that doing without moral frameworks is utterly impossible for us. Otherwise put, that the horizons within which we live our lives and which make sense of them have to include these strong qualitative discriminations. Moreover, this is not meant just as a contingently true psychological fact about human beings. Rather, the claim is that living within such strongly qualified horizons is constitutive of human agency itself, that stepping outside these limits would be tantamount to stepping outside what we would recognize as integral, undamaged human personhood." This is a quote from Sources of the Self. This is really talking about looking at the qualities of the will, not the pure choice alone, but the qualitative aspect of that, of choice. And he also cautions us that there can be a loss of self if we step outside these moral frameworks or we ignore them. We can hurt ourselves by not taking moral frameworks seriously. A crisis emerges with the loss of such a horizon, producing a disorientation of the self, the kind of phenomena that is endemic to nihilism. He notes that to begin to lose one's orientation is to be in crisis, both a moral and identity crisis, and to lose it utterly is to break down and enter a zone of extreme pathology. Currently, there is a growth industry in the study of narcissism and sociopathy. And along with Taylor, you might check in with philosopher Dallas Willard's book, The Disappearance of Moral Knowledge, which also relates to some of the current crises of our day. So there are basically three axes or three parameters of moral frameworks. Beliefs, first is the beliefs about value, the value of human life and the respect that is due others and what it will cost us, how it places demand on us. Secondly, beliefs about what kind of life is worth living, the noble or good life. This set of ideals permeates all our choices and actions. Thirdly, the dignity we afford ourselves and others, which is based on how we understand our role and usefulness to society and our place or calling within the larger scheme of things. You can see how all three of these axes relate to our healthy identity. There are two key components that Taylor wants to bring to our attention about a moral framework. One is the hypergood, the central passion within this moral framework, one which manages all the other goods. It arranges them in priority of importance. This good transcends the self and personal choice itself. So it, in a sense, would be that which really is a key driver in one's life. Now, many scientists have tried to come up with a scientific foundation for such a good or such for morality itself, such as Sam Harris in his book, The Moral Landscape. But J.D. Hunter, a sociologist at University of Virginia, and Paul Nedelecki wrote this book called Science and the Good, in which they argue that science cannot discover, produce, or offer a substitute for moral foundations. The second major point here, the second major component of the moral framework, is the hermeneutics, the conscious effort to figure out how all these goods are at play in one's life, in one's larger context and story. One also might say in one's community. We're called to grow and manage our moral self according to the goods we embrace. One is reminded of a famous commencement address by Alexander Solzhenitsyn in June 8, 1978, where he argued that the pursuit of happiness is not the correct pursuit for the modern world. Rather, we should be in pursuit of moral growth. If we were born to be happy, he said in that address, we would not be born to die. Because we're born with a limited time here on earth, it must mean that we are born to live out moral growth, that a purpose of our life must be moral progress. You can see this book, Solzhenitsyn at Harvard, the address, 12 early responses and 6 later reflections. So a lot of people have discussed this particular address. I think it was quite astounding and quite exciting for a lot of people, but also some people really resisted it. Doesn't agree with the American Constitution, for instance, or the pursuit of life, liberty, and happiness. Secondly, moral sources also work as sources of identity. In this area, we're talking about the inspiration, the issue of inspiration, imagination, reorientation, reconfiguration. And then we get in here to the concept of the constitutive good. And this speaks of realities or persons, contemplation of which or contact with which strengthens our moral commitment, our enthusiasm for the good. A force beyond us leads us in a creative interactive relationship with higher values and ideals. We feel a call. Example in point, Greta Thunberg on the climate change, this young teenager from Sweden who has gotten a lot of press in recent days, last fall especially. The second component about moral sources is the concept of epiphanies of transcendence. These can occur within the secular immanent frame. They involve such experiences as an encounter with God or natural beauty, impactful travel experiences, a great work of art or architecture, music or literature, maybe discovering an inspiring mentor here at the university. These dramatic encounters are important to personal growth and transformation. They can set a direction to one's life. Think of Moses and the burning bush, or Nelson Mandela in his Robben Island prison cell. Sometimes the epiphany takes 25 years before it really settles into us. These epiphanies dramatically shape one's identity and sense of calling. And you might find that students here at UBC long for such a breakthrough in higher education, that they come looking for something to pour their lives into, to pour their hearts into. Okay, so that's a bit on moral frameworks. We switch gears a little bit here to talk about language. Why is language important to the whole question of identity? And Taylor says that language is central to these moral sources that we've just been talking about. In fact, language, words, can open up new spaces for human meanings, for virtues, for identity, all sorts of things. It can help us discover new worlds, so to speak. In fact, he would say there is a sense in which words create these new worlds, our new understanding of the world that we live in. We humans are the animals with logos, said Aristotle, the language animal, Homo linguisticus. And you might remember that Paul Ricoeur, a professor at the University of Chicago, used to say to his PhD students, "Where are you speaking from?" That's your most fundamental question. When you start your thesis, where are you speaking from? And a PhD student will often be asked at their defense to explain how they got into the research topic that they are presenting for examination. So where are we speaking from? Language is very, very important to our discourse on identity. There are two, so in the language animal particularly, it happens before this, but it's very much front and center the discussion of the two distinct semantic logics, designative and constitutive. This is an important discussion, debate within language philosophy today. The first is the designative or instrumental tradition based in Hobbes, Locke, and Condillac. It's the language of science, statistics, and biology. Language is taken strictly, in this case, as a human instrument. The object exists first in the world, it's an objective thing, and then we name it. We say how it relates to other objects. Designative language is inherently restrictive and reductive. Thus, it is insufficient for robust human understanding, self-understanding. HLC is not good for the discourse of Canadian multiculturalism, for example. So there is a problem: if we only have designative language, can we really deal with the cultural mosaic of Canada, and can we really talk about how we are going to have dialogue across our differences? So the second kind of language, the second distinct language semantic logic that Taylor talks about, and it's a major focus of the language animal, is called constitutive or expressive. This is the tradition of Heyman, Herder, and Humboldt. It's important to metabiological or human meaning. We get into purpose, call, identity, moral understanding. Language impacts what we see and how we experience the world. It evolves as we invent new terms, new expressions, even whole new fields of articulacy as we employ new symbols and metaphors. We recognize and bring to expression new domains of meaning. Taylor says there's a kind of dialogue back and forth between language and enactments, so between human experience of the world and also the language we use to describe that and to predict future experience. A kind of antiphony. We'll see that in future slides. The major insight, though, as we look at these, now Taylor must understand, he believes in both type of language, that they both have their place in human culture, and they are both part of the larger human linguistic capacity. But this is an important rejoinder. In light of this, he says, it is clear that the scientific zone can only be a suburb of the vast, sprawling city of language and could never be the metropolis itself. This is from a quote from the language animal. So he says, why then do so many see the designative language, the designative semantic logic, as the most important, if not the only, theory of language? Why all the rage against tropes and metaphors? He challenges us to ask, what are we humans like at our best, at our fullest linguistic capacity? So in a secular age, he already began to build up to this. He already set up an aporia or a problem. And he said, our language has lost, within modernity, within the immanent frame, there is a sense in which our language has lost its constitutive power. This means that we can deal instrumentally with realities around us, but their deeper meaning, the background in which they exist, the higher reality which finds expression in them, is ignored and often invisible to us. Our language, he says, has lost the power to name things in their embedding, their deeper, richer, and higher reality. Our language, our vision, and our lives often remain flattened in late modernity. That's from the Secular Age 761. He also noted in a talk that he gave in Australia recently, in 2016, that George Lakoff and Mark Johnson have a major area of research on metaphors in this book, Metaphors We Live By. There's a very robust, growing discussion in that area of scholarship. So constitutive language helps us to promote the mature, thick, growing identity. That's what we want to argue from here on forward. This zone is the site of attempts to define the shape of significance, human significance, purpose. Its expressions, be they enactments or verbal articulations in symbol or philosophical prose, all aim to sketch some contour or facet of this overall shape of meaning in the hope of an ultimate ratification in felt intuition or resonance. So language, constitutive language is empowering. Words help us understand a phenomena of human life, in fact help us to shape human experience. You may need to take a deep breath at this point. But anyway, we're moving on. So there are three rungs of the ladder of identity. That is, three areas or spaces for understanding and shaping human meaning. Rung number one, Taylor calls the habitus. This involves the everyday received culture that we are all born into, together with its regular activities, the pre-articulate tacit elements, things that are enacted, embodied, performativity, praxis, ritual. Habitus includes existential habits, relationships, and commitments, along with a pre-existing skein or web of meanings. The meaning is built, it's hardwired right into the community that one is born into, the family. Think about the challenging adjustment, for instance, of a Syrian refugee family coming to Vancouver to figure out our world, coming from their world to our world. It's a shock to their system. Examples of habitus would be wedding, bathing a child, a funeral, a family meal, planting a tree, justice activity like defending the homeless or the Lord's Prayer. So that's rung number one. Rung number two is the verbal articulation. So what habitus involved was a pre-articulate or tacit dimension of experience. This is where the individual really wants to get that articulate grasp of reality. This involves naming a norm together with its crucial feature, a code or principles or precepts, rights, virtues to emulate, a family of values. We need to get words active in this process. This can be also be captured by a great work of art, an exemplary life like Martin Luther King Jr., or a poem or a music concert. It can involve a symbol, a metaphor, or a meaningful story, such as we find in Les Misérables or The Brothers Karamazov. Articulation helps us grasp reality in a fresh way. It is articulate meanings which actually animate our lives. On the bottom here, I've shown you some people who have really contributed to the articulate grasp of the world. Malcolm Gydig, a creative Cambridge University poet, has captivated people with this gift of articulation. He's been a recent visitor to Regent and UBC. Or you might know about singer-songwriter, guitarist Bruce Cockburn, a famous poet, who's really captured the ethos of Canada, the struggle of identity and development and personal growth and moral questions. Or Gerard Manley Hopkins or George Herbert or Wordsworth. We all have our own favorite articulate people. The third rung is the hermeneutical account or the raison d'etre, the why. This is discerning its overall role in our lives. For instance, the reason for the code, the constitution, the praxis, or family principles. This is the rational aspect of metabiological meaning. It requires both definition and clarification. And Taylor makes a strong emphasis that the parts of this are always understood in terms of the larger whole. That's key to the hermeneutical outlook. This offers a space for fruitful dialogue with the other, with a cross difference. When you understand your own hermeneutical grasp, your own raison d'etre, your own reason why, it's easier to talk to other people and ask them questions about their reason for existence, their purpose in life. So at the end of the day, though, one can either internalize the code from the family or the culture or the religion, or question it altogether, examine it or resist it. Millennials, in fact, are asking today, how can we live in the house of meaning constructed by our forebears, or how can we create a new one of our own? That is a very real, palpable concern of theirs. Another note on hermeneutics or interpretation. Hermeneutics helps us make sense of human actions and reactions, responses and attitudes, behavioral causes and effects. This kind of reflection makes these humanly understandable, graspable, and palpable, or real for us. Such interpretation of self happens against the backdrop of a whole landscape of meanings within which an agent operates. This includes a whole constellation of motives, norms, and virtues. So searching for coherence within ourselves, within our moral framework, is essential to a healthy, robust identity, essential to our basic integrity. Another aspect of this that Taylor talks about is the trajectory, the story trajectory. We each have our own story. We're each writing our story to some extent. And he talks about this concept of gestalt or take on the world and how important that is for one's sense of health, health of identity. That if one does not have a sense of the progress of one's story, what means progress? What does progress mean for me? It can lead to an existential identity crisis. On the issue of hermeneutics, I recommend Jens Zimmermann's little book, Hermeneutics, A Very Short Introduction. And I want to say that we're not talking about the realm of proof here, but more the realm of plausibility. But it is real human knowledge. Hermeneutical knowledge or interpretive knowledge is real knowledge of self and of the world. So it's not to be taken lightly or ignored. So here's a summary of Taylor's ladder of identity. Meanings are a combination, a ladder of enactments, performance, articulations, and finally interpretations. Quote, we make these meanings exist for us by enacting them, then expressing them, naming them, critically examining them, arguing about them, fighting sometimes about them. But truth is also involved. As we grow morally, our maturing meanings involve us in seeing better, believing better, and ultimately living better lives. So you can see there's a sense of progressive trajectory in Taylor's project. Certain moral goods can inform our feelings and give us access to new domains of life, open new gates for our identity. I'm just citing a movie that's based on a true story of Heinrich Harrer, an Austrian hiker, super outdoorsman, who eventually ends up in Lhasa meeting the Dalai Lama. They become friends. It's a 1997 movie. Quite an interesting story about how one's life improves as one comes to grip with some of these issues, some of this question of this ladder of identity. I thought of it as I watched it recently, I thought of it as a good example of what Taylor is talking about here. Okay, now we move to the third and final stage of this presentation, and that is application. We want to address a current existential conundrum. He calls it, in the Western identity in general, he calls it the crisis of affirmation. It haunts the psyche of many people today, and it can spark a crisis of self, a crisis of identity and meaning. In fact, American psychologist Greg Heinrichs, in an online Psychology Today series, believes that we have entered an existential identity crisis in the West, that we are in danger in some ways, if we don't pay attention to what's going on, of cultural collapse. Quite a controversial statement, but something to pay attention to, I think. So this is a deep structure identity question, a deep structure dilemma, the crisis of affirmation. Charles Taylor claims that we are caught on the horns of a dilemma within our immanent frame, between self-hatred and moral or spiritual lobotomy. The angst is palpable. A terrible inner human suffering occurs with this. It implies the struggle in a broken world to see both the world and the self as good. Either we hate ourselves for our moral failure, or we hate and reject the very morality that makes us feel guilty in the first place, leading to a spiritual lobotomy. We just cut morality out of our thinking, or we settle for a form of relativism or moral subjectivism where it doesn't really matter as long as I feel good about it. This results in nihilism, often self-harm, both spiritual and psychological and social and personal, sometimes physical self-harm, or scapegoating and violence. Morality, identity, and spirituality. Taylor argues that the human is inherently a moral entity, that we find ourselves on a moral journey. The self is always situated in moral space, that's how he puts it. Selfhood and the good, or selfhood and morality, turn out to be inextricably intertwined themes. And he goes on to say that morality, identity, and spirituality are intimately interwoven. This is one of the most profound things that he is saying. It's a real touchstone. So what is his proposed solution to the crisis? Taylor suggests that late in the Sources of the Self, a transcendent turn to agape love can provide a way out of this dilemma of guilt, shame, low self-esteem on the one hand, or moral and spiritual suicide on the other. The move allows us to ground the self in robust meaning amid suffering and tragedy. And transcendence, I should underline, is the critical factor here, as we will see. We invoke both the moral and the spiritual dimensions of human consciousness and well-being, as do many academics in the field of positive psychology. Psychology has come a long way from being a totally atheistic discipline under Freud to what it is today. So what we want to focus on is the vertical or T2 strong transcendence. Charles Taylor speaks of this strong type of transcendence, one that does not involve escaping the world, nor do we have to take a position of contempt for or harm towards the world, nor to fear or scapegoat the other. That is very, very significant. It's a significant stance. It respects the plurality of being, and he also has backup from philosopher Calvin Schrag at Purdue in his book, The Self After Modernity, where he gives complementary insights to Taylor on the distinction between strong and weak transcendence. Weak transcendence is a horizontal transcendence. I grow, I become a new person, I develop my education, etc. Strong transcendence speaks of the connection with the divine or the supernatural. We want to place a wager on such strong transcendence as a route to mature identity. Okay, there are basically two scenarios that Taylor outlines in stark contrast to each other. Scenario one, or stance posture number one, is we close ourselves off to grace out of a loathing for self and the world. Because this is so painful, we automatically tend to project the evil outward in an act of polarization between self and the world, self and others. We are both alienated and disgusted. We rationalize that this justifies terror itself, that evil world must be destroyed, we think. The problem of my angst is with the other. It's their problem. We cannot associate our identity with such a world, cannot accept being part of it. And brilliantly, Dostoevsky in The Brothers Karamazov showed how terrorism is a spiritual response to such self-hatred, self-loathing. That's a key idea in psychology. So it's suicide for the noble or terror for the ignoble. This is the only choice we seem to have. And of course, you can see in this, the human vice of pride is quite involved, arrogance, deceit, and resentment. We see this in young people who are involved in school shootings or who run off to Iraq to join ISIS. Scenario number two is in stark contrast. In a radically different stance, we can invoke transcendent agape love. It allows us to love both the world and self at the same time, despite the world's brokenness and injustice. We accept that we are part of the world and accept our part, our responsibility for its evil and brokenness. And this constitutes an epiphany. This miracle comes through accepting love from others and from God. We open ourselves to grace. Therefore, we switch over from the economy of blame or projection to an economy of grace and openness. This involves a paradigm shift towards the self and the world, resulting in these kind of virtues, humility, servanthood, other orientation, and hospitality. So how is agape, in effect, a life force or of transformation? The strong version of transcendence means that while such love comes from outside human culture, it offers transforming dynamics within the economies of the full range of culture spheres in science, the arts, ethics, and religion. This has implication for all academic pursuits, all academicians. Taylor believes that this epiphanic discovery of agape love can act as a hypergood. It can cause a rearrangement of the hierarchy of one's moral goods, a real rearrangement of the self, bringing about both a transfiguration and transvaluation of one's values. This impacts one's motivation for embracing the good, respecting, learning from, reaching out, sacrificing for the other. A good example of this is Jean Vanier in his book, Becoming Human. Vanier, on visiting a friend, a priest in France, discovered a beautiful experience of him reaching out and building community for people with a mental handicap. And this changed Jean Vanier's life completely. And as you know, he has made a profound impact in this area by starting the International L'Arche community. Some of you have probably visited those communities. So transcendence as epiphany. The self is receiver, but a receiver not of a content, a proposition, or truth, but of a presence. A presence as power. There's a personal impact here. Furthermore, this presence provides the inexpressible confirmation of meaning. You can feel it at a deep level in your inner self, in your soul, a meaning that calls out to be done, to be confirmed by the self in this life and in this world. It draws you to the world, not to run away from it. This confirmation and this affirmation of God and self in the world are what Taylor calls a change stance towards self in the world, which doesn't simply recognize a hitherto occluded good, but rather helps to bring this about. This is a quote from Michael Morgan, a commentator on Taylor's philosophy. We might also see the work on epiphany in Richard Kearney, his book, Anatheism, Returning to God After God. Very much a book written for the post-secular age. So there's a new orientation. As the individual encounters the radically transcendent other, this person is reoriented in the presence of the inaccessible. It involves both an existential I-thou encounter and a revelation or illumination. This is where one is taken beyond the present realized bounds of oneself to discover new unknown depth, to expand one's identity. The self is coming in touch with that which lies beyond it, a ground or qualitative preeminence. One becomes open to that empowerment. Here Taylor uses the language of articulation again. The process involves naming a good in its depth and illuminating its power as the engine for ethical discourse, for change, and for agency. In fact, Taylor says, this is what we actually mean when we say that God is love. It's not just saying a fact about the universe, it's saying something very profound, very moving. It moves the universe when you use that phrase. So agape as a source of identity and significance. God's love is one active contemporary source of the good, the love of which has empowered, this is the constitutive aspect of things. God's love is one active contemporary source of the good, the love of which has empowered people to do the good and exemplify the good in their character, social life, and politics. Taylor suggests that to avoid nihilism and the settling for violence, we need a transcendent turn to avoid the extreme of self-hatred, guilt and shame, or alternatively, the extremity of hating morality itself, spiritual lobotomy, which is the death of culture. The transcendent turn to agape becomes vital. We quote Taylor at this point, the only way to escape fully the draw towards violence, he writes, lies somewhere in the turn to transcendence. That is, through the full-hearted love of some good beyond life. This is from a book called A Catholic Modernity. So we're reaching a resolution of our conundrum of the crisis of affirmation. Taylor hopes for a participation with the divine that returns us to this world in such a way that we are able to fully embrace our deepest spiritual aspirations, our highest ideals, and fully to affirm the world, others, and ourselves without spiritual mutilation and without simply denying the reality of suffering and evil. This is a miraculous transformation indeed. As a thinker situated within mainstream Western culture, Taylor's proposed path to resolution of the crisis of affirmation, it involves appeals to God, grace, and agape, and there's no a priori reason to judge these appeals false or misleading. This is from a paper by William Greenway on Charles Taylor's philosophy. So in conclusion, in the modern quest for meaning and strong identity amid suffering and tragedy, the West is not without a response from its own philosophical, cultural, and spiritual tradition. We have deep roots in this. Agape love, according to Taylor, posits a stance towards self and the world that is morally courageous and life-affirming. It enhances the common good and promotes the well-being of the community, affirms the potential of this complex Canadian cultural mosaic as we reach out to one another. It offers to reduce violence, promote justice, increase dialogue across difference, improve the quality of opportunity, and increase the individual's mature responsibility, mature identity growth. All of this is in line with mature and integrated identity growth, as I've said. Taylor suggests that the first question we should be asking, the first moral, spiritual identity question we should pose is, who or what do we love, rather than what are we obliged to do, which is a traditional ethical question. So millennials have a new opportunity here for collaboration, for personal and cultural renewal, and they should take full advantage of the language of Taylor, the language of constitutive discourse. I just want to finally cite Larry Seedentop from Oxford University and his book Inventing the Individual, the Origins of Western Culture, Western Liberalism, Larry Seedentop does an amazing job of digging into the ancient world and showing how agape love was actually part of full-on transformation of culture, setting it on a new foundation. Well, that's all I want to say at this point. Thank you very much for your attention, and I hope this has been a helpful introduction to some of the key points of Charles Taylor as he seeks to show us the potential for the quest for identity in today's late modern world. Thank you.